Welcome to 3GT, the podcast where three guys, a pastor, a parishioner, and a professor, theologize about life's issues from a Reformed perspective without losing their sense of humor.
Well, January 22nd has been somewhat of a day that has really brought a dark stain upon the life of our nation. And January 22nd of this year, 2017, will be the 44th anniversary of the landmark case of Roe versus Wade, which, of course, recognized a constitutional right for mothers to abort their children. And I imagine that Barry and Aaron were well aware of the statistics of abortion. I think probably just shy of 60 million little children have been murdered in their mother's wombs in the last 44 years. And of course, there's all kinds of other heartbreaking statistics that go along with that. And obviously, I think it goes without saying that we would all be very opposed to abortion on biblical grounds and just on decent humanity in some ways. I think it is a stain on our nation. But one of the things that I've wondered often, not just as a citizen, but as a pastor, as people have asked me, as I've dealt with people as well, what do you guys think are some of the actual useful ways that we can help voice our concern and our hatred for abortion? What are some of the useful things that we can do to try to raise awareness and if the Lord is willing to bring an end to abortion in our nation? You know, it's a topic that draws the strongest reactions on both sides of the spectrum. And sometimes I have to admit, I sit back and I look at some of the things, especially that pro-life advocates do, and I sometimes wonder how useful that actually is or what that actually accomplishes. But I guess that's the question I want to throw out there. I have some thoughts, but I'd like to hear from you guys first. What are some practical things that we can be doing, not only as the church, but as citizens of this nation to bring an end to abortion?
Well, I think one of the things is just to hear stories and testimonies. To me, that always is so powerful. You know, you've probably been to maybe a Right to Life banquet, and whether it's an abortion survivor or someone who's, you know, been affected by abortion, sometimes just hearing those testimonies can be very moving and powerful because it personalizes it. I think so many people, you know, just talk about right to life, a woman's right to choose, and it remains impersonal, or you know, only one person's being considered, the woman, for instance, and helping people to more personalize it, I think, is very, very important. You know, one of the credible stories is that the lady in Roe v. Wade, Norma McCorvey, you know, ends up regretting that she was used in this manner to promote this legislation. She's since repented and been converted and is now an advocate for the Right to Life movement. So I think telling people those types of stories can be very inspiring and moving, because it's really not, you know, just a matter of getting legislation changed, but it's really a matter of changing people's hearts first and foremost so that we cannot ultimately see the laws in our land changed.
So something that I like to try to tease out, at least when I'm talking to individual people, is just to figure out, you know, why do they fall on either side of the conversation? What is it that's driving that? And typically that's going to boil down to, you know, as you were mentioning, you know, rights of an individual. Are we talking about the rights of one person, the rights of two people? But it's the people conversation or the personhood conversation that I think is if you really pin most people on, that's where the decision is going to be made. It, you know, a lot of it is emotionally driven. A lot of it is driven by story. But a lot of the circles that I run in, especially in science land and education land and, you know, things that are out, circles of friends that are outside the church, defining what a person is, who a person is, when a person actually becomes a person, when we talk, you know, you're talking half a batch of chromosomes from a mother, half a batch of chromosomes from a father, from the point those two chunks of chromosomes meet, at what point do we have life? And really teasing out, you know, is it when the heart starts beating, or is it when those chromosomes are now within the same cell? I mean, at what point do you ontologically have a human being, and what rights does that human being have, regardless of where it actually resides, inside or outside of another person's body? So teasing out those finer details and trying to pin people down, not pin them down in a bad way, but hone in on where do they fall on those things. And some people I've found have not even thought through the whole process of conception and through the whole process of what defines a person and when at what point does someone become a person, and to tease out those arguments is I find to be helpful sometimes, rather than trying to go for the big overarching, you know, let's convince the entire city of Pittsburgh that abortion is wrong. My tact with most things is sit down and have a cup of coffee with somebody and see what makes them tick.
Do you think when you've brought up the questions of personhood, and I think you're spot on with that in many ways, have you found that to be helpful? I've tried to bring that up with people, and they not only have they not thought about it, there is such, if I can say this without sounding too snooty, there's such an aversion to sound logic in our world today that I found those arguments to just be blatantly dismissed, like, it doesn't matter when personhood begins. Have you found more success? Have you found people willing to interact with you on that level?
I don't think I've ever been shut down on, what you're talking about in terms of it doesn't matter when personhood begins. I think there's a disagreement on when that actually does happen. And I think the philosophical argument is a much stronger argument than the medical argument. So I tend to try to take people that direction, but I'm not sure I've encountered anyone just, you know, shutting me down on that level. And if they do, they're obviously not, you know, willing to have that conversation. It's time to move on to another conversation. So
I often think it's, you know, when you get into those types of arguments or discussions that, you know, the use of analogy. People are not consistent when they're sitting here defending abortion for whatever reason it may be, and to try to use different analogies to persuade them or help them to see that they're not making that same application in other areas of life can be helpful, so that you're not, you know, just trying to out-argue them, but reason with them and help them to see where they're off.
What responsibility do you guys, and actually I would love to hear both perspectives, Aaron, you being somebody in the pew, and Barry, you being somebody who's stood in the pulpit. What responsibility do you think the church has? Aaron, what do you want to hear maybe from your pastor or your elders? Barry, have you ever preached on this topic, and how do you avoid simply preaching to the choir? You know, I think most of our churches would, by and large, I think it would be safe to say that most people in them would be opposed to abortion. What responsibility do you think the church has to this social issue?
I think one thing that can be done is to address some of the, I would say, common criticisms of the pro-life side of the argument. One of the common ones that I encounter is, you know, people accuse Christians of being pro-life for the unborn.
Yes.
But they're pro-war, they're pro, you know, insert other things. And we could, you know, tease out the nuance of this, but capital punishment often comes up, you know, gun control comes up, letting murder of certain racial groups comes up without, you know, people intervening. Those are the types of questions that are being thrown back at us. And so, you know, a sermon about, you know, the sanctity of life is very important, and it is important that we support that, you know, the right of the unborn, but I think addressing and arming the congregation with being able to engage in those other conversations that are being kicked back at us is very important.
Yeah, and I think if I can, before Barry answers, to piggyback on that, you know, it seems to me, I wonder sometimes if that has been a serious blind spot with some pro-life people. I think it's a fair criticism to say, if you're going to be pro-life in, you know, you need to be pro-life in all of life. And I don't necessarily agree with then the conclusions or some of the avenues by which many people will believe you are, you know, I don't think capital punishment is anti-pro-life, but I do think it's a common criticism, and one that I think we need to address, that as the church, we do need to be concerned. You know, it's not enough to say, hey, you know, as a mother, please don't abort your child. Is the church going to step in now and help be pro-life for this child and for this mother who needs some desperate help? But
I think that speaks to the need to train people how to discuss things persuasively and to be ready. You know, Christian apologetics, you hear people talk about apologetics today, and it often just ventures off into the realms of, you know, more philosophical type arguments when we talk about apologetics. But, you know, real, true, good working apologetics is where the rubber meets the road and you're speaking to the issues of the day. And I think we have to train our people more practically. You know, it's amazing if you have a cult, you know, person from a cult come to your door, some of the very first things you might start saying to them, they're prepared to answer you back to try to, you know, to try to meet your objections. We need to help our people be more offensive minded in this issue in terms of being able to counter some of the resistance they're going to meet with initially by having, you know, good foundational biblical arguments in addressing these matters.
Barry, have you ever preached on the issue of abortion?
Oh yes, yeah. And not just, you know, your passing reference. I mean, I've often used the pulpit in January to have a, you know, we wouldn't like celebrate sanctity of life or anything like that, but we would acknowledge what was going on in our culture and have a message directed that way.
Did you ever find it difficult to not, I mean, what ideas did you have to not just simply be preaching to the choir, so to speak, but what were some of the angles from which you looked at abortion?
Well, part of it was to just remind people, you know, God's people, of how repulsive it is. You know, we can all say it's wrong, it's bad, it's evil, but because we don't see it every day, it's easy to go and not really think about it. And part of our duty as pastors is to highlight the, you know, our prophetic role is to highlight the evils of our day and explain those evils in such a way that people feel about those evils the way that God does. When you look at prophetic literature in the Old Testament, and you know, the prophets wanted to speak against, for instance, the sacrificing of children, they wouldn't just say it, they would also picture what that looked like before God. And I think we must do the same. We don't want to be, in a sense, overly graphic. You know, I don't need to sit there and describe with precision what happens in abortion, but I think we need to be willing to say some things that aren't easy on the ears to hear, not easy for the children in the congregation to hear, but they need to realize this is the world that they're in. They need to be thankful for parents who've allowed them to live, and we need to equip them to be thinking about sin like God sees it. I, to me, that's really one of the first things at the heart of it all.
What about, so, you know, when you think of some of the pro-life activities, you know, there's petitions. You could probably find dozens of petitions online to sign to end abortion. There's marches, there's fundraising, there's protests and picket lines. There's, you know, groups that go to college campuses and stand in the center square and just cry out against abortion. I wonder sometimes, do you think people in the pro-life movement sometimes feel the need to validate every avenue by which people are trying to raise awareness. Do you think there's ever a place for us to say, you know, maybe that avenue is casting pearls before swine, and we could be better served by directing our energy in this direction rather than that one? Does that question make sense?
Mm-hmm. I think we talked a little bit about this, you know, in the pre-Aaron days when we were discussing the Wilberforce moment. Kyle, I remember that, where these videos were rolling out that were showing in abortion clinics people wheeling and dealing and selling body parts of aborted infants. And, you know, there was some graphic scenes there of aborted children. And we wondered, you know, how effective that was, and had some of these discussions, you know, how effective is it for those groups to go on campus and hold up huge signs with aborted fetuses on it, for instance? Is that proper or not? I wrestle with it. It's not something I would do, but on the other hand, I have a hard time condemning someone for doing that if they're feeling led to that. But you don't want to become like the Westboro Baptist Church either, where, you know, the world sees the church and all it sees are red, angry faces with veins popping out of the side of their necks yelling and condemning them. I just don't think that's effective. So I think how you use those kinds of more graphic measures, it has to be done carefully, or I think it could be very self-defeating.
Aaron, do you have any thoughts you want to add?
Yeah, I'm struggling to articulate what's rattling around in my head. Barry, I agree. I've never been a fan of the graphic exposure thing. So, I look at it this way. If I were not a Christian and I didn't value sexual relationships the way I do, and I was just a promiscuous person, and I viewed abortion as a form of birth control to make sure that my life was not inconvenienced by a child, clearly my heart is not at a point to reject the concept of abortion, and seeing a graphic image shoved in my face is not going to deter me in any way, shape, or form from going to get that abortion. This is also assuming that I'm a female in this conversation, but I'm not. Sorry. But so, I mean, at that point, I think we have to look at this from, you know, an evangelism and a discipleship perspective. Like, that person's heart is not going to be changed to not want an abortion unless their heart has been changed to want Christ. So I don't see the point in some of those things when they're not met first with discipleship, with evangelism, with trying to show people Christ and the love that Christ has for sinners, and then having their heart turn from sin. We're not going to turn their heart from sin with a graphic image, and that's not going to probably take them to Christ. Now, I could be wrong, and I'm sure there are instances where that has happened, but I don't think that should be the norm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It reminds me of, you know, what Rosaria Butterfield is spoken of in a, you know, different realm, in the realm of homosexuality, that our goal is not to cause people to quit just being homosexuals. It's to see them transformed into the image of Christ. And so we have to, obviously we want them to repent. They have to repent of these evils, but it's not just changing merely a behavior. It's got to be, you know, heart change that really impacts, to see a real impact as we talk about culturally and, you know, the role of the church. So one of the things we don't want to become, I believe, as a church that's known more just for the fact that it yells a lot about abortion, but isn't really practicing the love of Christ or preaching truly the gospel of Christ. Churches can get off-centered and become very issue-focused rather than gospel-centered. And again, that's not to say that we don't cry out against the evils of this day, but we can't do that without also, I think, putting the whole package together. You know, a lot of young ladies need care And perhaps if they were shown love and a place where this baby could be born, then they might be willing to let that child live. And so, you know, all the movements around our country to offer safe pregnancy centers to come into, the huge push for adoption services that you see in the pro-life community, particularly in the Christian community. To me, those things are good and right and essential in this whole battle. One of the things my daughter, just she has a real heart for this since she went to college. I mean, she grew up with it, but especially expressed it more as she went to college. And currently, she's going around through a Right to Life group, and they're going into the public schools. And of course, they can't teach out and out, just preach the gospel in the public schools. It's not allowed, but they're able to share in such a ways about abstinence. And they do work at personalizing, you know, the decisions that people make. So they're really getting their approaches to really try to help young people think about how every decision they make is important and can be life altering. And so it's been encouraging just to hear some of her encounters. And she told me the story of being in a, you know, she goes and talks to junior high kids and talking, you know, to seventh and eighth grade boys. But as they were in the class talking about what an abortion was, one of these young boys started weeping because he had never realized even what abortion was. And so, you know, and God's common grace of helping people just understand this world in which they live, you know, she could see this young boy being touched by just that presentation. So I guess part of what I'm trying to get at, Kyle, is to me, it's just a multi-faceted approach. I don't think there's just, and I know you're not saying this, but there's just not just one means. I think there are many means, and there are many different gifts that we could be using in the church to that continue to offer those in this battle. This episode of 3GT is sponsored by the Reformed Presbyterian Theological Seminary. RPTS is the fifth oldest seminary in the United States, and in its over 200 years of existence has maintained a theological fidelity to the Word of God. Housed in the historic Horn Mansion on the east end of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, RPTS is in a beautiful setting that invites you to come and study the great truths of the Scriptures. Though we're an old institution, we're not a static one. Our motto is study under pastors, and we have been busy developing programs and courses that will help prepare men and women for a life of service in God's kingdom in the 21st century. As I travel about the church and talk to people about theological education, many people wonder about it. I have young men ask me, how do I know if I'm being called into the ministry, or wondering if they could handle the classwork at the seminary level. Young ladies often wonder if it would be good for them to get some theological education so that they could serve the church and Christ's kingdom more efficiently. And to them, I often say what I'm going to say to you now. Why not take a glimpse into RPTS? For we now offer many of our classes online in our distance learning program. And I have a special offer for you at this time. If you would like to audit one of our classes just to see what it would be like to study at RPTS, you can do that for a total price of only $99. Yes, just $99 to audit one of our courses. If you'd be interested in doing that, all you have to do is send an email to apply@rpts.edu. That's APPLY at rpts.edu, and mention that you heard about this on 3GT. If you'd like to find out more about the seminary, you can go to our website at rpts.edu.